music blares. Blares, blares, blares. Is there any escape from noise? Is there any escape from noise? Is there any escape from noise? Is there any escape from noise?
Good evening. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is your weekly installment of the Escape from Noise show. We've got a couple of special guests here in studio tonight. Regular fans will know them already. That is, of course, Greg and George, the British Boys Brain Club here tonight to share some thoughts with you. How are you doing, guys?
Hi, everyone.
Fine. It's cold.
Yeah.
It's wet.
My voice is broken.
Yeah. The two things Britain's most known for being, cold and wet.
And dysfunctional.
Dysfunctional. Yeah, well, I think we're joining you now on that. we're competing to be the most dysfunctional former great power. Yeah, the reason I brought Greg and George in for the show tonight is to do a special Escape from Noise show. We're not going to be talking about a musician, but instead a academic writer. What else is he?
Anthropologist.
Anthropologist. Yeah.
Activist.
Activist. All around great guy. David Graeber, who recently passed away. I think it was in October of 2020, wasn't it? It was pretty recent.
Like September, even.
September, okay. Yeah, but he's, I don't know, I mean, I don't even know how to begin speaking about him, but he's someone who's had an impact on me, for sure, and on both Greg and George in a number of ways, so we figured it was worth taking a couple hours to talk about his life and his work. So where to begin? Greg, I think you said you had you could do like a little short biography of David Graeber, just I don't know that much about him.
I think just to say like why I would love to talk about David too. I think he's like, there's not many people who kind of, especially for us three, have kind of, I don't know, impacted all of our lives in like the same way. I can't think of many people like him really. And yeah, he's just a bit of a kind of hero, and it feels nice to be able to celebrate people. And I feel like he also kind of threads like different parts of our friendship together. And there's a lot to say. But so basically he was this guy.
Can I jump in and give my reason as well?
Oh yeah, go ahead, yeah.
Because I like definitely agree with that. There was somehow like this like coalescence of like all of our lives together with activism about 2 years ago, and then also meeting David Graeber like in and amongst all of that, and then kind of getting kind of not close to him but like knowing him and meeting him at various activist events,
also known as protests.
Yeah, and like various meetings, you know, the never-ending meetings. But yeah, he gave me like this real sense of hope. And like that he was a guy that was like, oh, it's great that we've got him on our side, you know, like,
yeah,
it's great that he's down with us on the barricade kind of thing. And yeah, like, I guess we'll talk about all the things that we all like about him, like throughout the podcast, but like his way of distilling complex ideas into something like, yeah, quite simple or commonsensical. That's what I really liked about him. It was always quite inspiring and like provoking kind of, or yeah, making you think and question like basic assumptions that exist in society. I thought that was something really quite good about David.
Yeah, I love the way that you describe him as, yeah, just this like beacon of hope. I feel like maybe that's why we're talking about him now as well, sort of like midwinter, past like Christmas, deep in the grips of COVID, sort of like bleak. We could use a little ray of light.
Yeah, God, could we?
Absolutely. If I can jump in also, I think my like big reason for wanting to talk about David Graeber is I feel like for the time that I've been involved in politics or whatever you want to say, like I find that I'm always one of the most like cynical people in the room. Like I'm always the one like thinking, sometimes even saying, oh, like, no, that's never going to work. You know, like you just like look at what's happening in the world around us right now. Like any sort of like movement that we're trying to build or like thing we'd be trying to achieve. It's like, oh, that's not very realistic, is it? But then like when you listen to David Graeber speak, you like read his books, he's got this just like unquenchable like spirit for change, this kind of optimism that's also somehow like very realistic. You know, he's got this way of looking at the world in which you can see it changing very easily. You know, it almost like honestly, one of the reasons that I wanted to do the show is I think that if everybody out there just like knew about David Graeber's work, like. Like we could change so much stuff, you know, so that's why I want to get it out there, hopefully teach our lovely audience tonight something. So
yeah,
brilliant.
There's like a spirit that we want to like keep alive somehow. Yeah, I love that. I guess I'll just do a bit of like context, like who, like where did he come from and what did he do.
Perfect.
Just in case, you know, people have no idea. So he's, you know, an American, a Jewish American, born in the US, and basically became an academic, studied kind of anthropology, wrote, I think his first book was about the kind of a theory of value in anthropology. He spent a lot of time in Madagascar, doing kind of field work, ethnography. And just to say, I guess anthropology, for people that don't know, so like anthropology really is like the study of humans. And I think it's kind of different from something like, you know, political science or sociology or economics, in the way that it really is all about, it's less about kind of theory and it's more about what people are doing on the ground and really trying to deeply understand the like cultural, like everyday lives of people and how they experience the world. And it's really focused on like detail for that reason. So whereas sociology, say, is trying to come up with big like general rules and stories for how society exists, anthropology is trying to understand a specific time and place and people. So it's got this really kind of like almost like practical detail to it, which is really, yeah, I think why he was drawn to it. Yeah, I guess it's important to say that, you know, he's also a kind of anarchist, and we can talk about that more in a minute. But one of his sort of early books as well was called Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, which really was trying to like bring these two worlds together that have so much in common. And yeah, later on, kind of after a few years really heavily involved in what's now, kind of, I think it's called the kind of alter globalization movement.
The what globalization movement?
Alter.
Anti, right?
Oh, yeah, I always thought of it as anti-globalization, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard both, actually. I don't really know. Global justice movement. Just like, basically in the like late 90s, there's big kind of like global movement of people protesting the way that big like international institutions were forcing a version of kind of neoliberal capitalism onto everybody. And yeah, there were street movements made up of all kinds of different people who were doing direct action, which basically means, you know, pretending as if the rules that exist don't exist, you know, living as if you're already free. And they were blocking these big conferences. The World Trade Organization in Seattle was kind of a famous one, famous moment. And actually that was the subject of an ethnography that he wrote, which was called Direct Action. Yeah, which I'd love to talk a little bit more about later, which is really good. I think has kind of touched us all and touched loads of people. And yeah, and then I guess he became really famous after Occupy Wall Street, this, again, like global movement to protest against economic inequality, but the system that produces it mainly. He was kind of being credited with coming up with the the slogan, "We are the 99%," and was a kind of pretty vocal sort of figurehead of that whole thing.
Although, to be fair, he took every chance he could get to say that he didn't actually invent the phrase himself. He says he in the room while it was being written, but he was kind of like one of the big like figureheads of the movie, you know, of that like decentralized thing. He was one of the people that was often like on TV and on radio speaking for the movement. So I think he got kind of assigned the role of being the "We Are the 99% guy. But
Yeah. And he wrote a great book about it called The Democracy Project, which is really interesting about democracy kind of like generally. And then after Occupy, or maybe it was during Occupy, he was doing loads of research on debt.
2011, I think, came out.
Really?
Yeah.
And after Occupy, that kind of spawned another movement, the debt drop,
yeah, campaign to end debt or something like that.
Yeah, we should know that. Hey, the debt resistance group. it was called like a jubilee. It was about basically exposing like what debt is and how debt creates kind of like enslaved subjects and kind of keeps people locked into this system. Anyway, a massive book, and it has like become popular among loads of different types of people. You know, people who you like really wouldn't think would be interested in what an anarchist anthropologist has to say about anything, kind of mainstream politicians. I think I heard the governor of the Bank of England, the former governor of Bank of England, talking about it the other day. And that kind of is like true for a lot of his books. So a book that came later, Bullshit Jobs, became really popular kind of across the left.
He was on like mainstream news networks in
The Guardian all the time.
Not to interrupt, but I think that's like one of his like biggest gifts is like the ability to take these ideas that would be considered like left ideas, but then present them in a way that's just like most people would obviously agree with them because they're just so common sense. Like the Bullshit Jobs book, I think, is one of the best examples of that.
Yeah, and it was basically the I mean, maybe we'll go into it in a minute, but the essence of that book was for whatever reason, this system that we're living in is forcing people to work in ways that aren't productive to the sort of general well-being at all. Like, we're so wedded to the idea of work and jobs that we will kind of create busy work, bureaucracy. And there's some crazy statistic, like, you know, 60% of people think that their job isn't contributing anything meaningful to society. And it's like, you know, in a way, it's kind of a conventional critique. Like, a lot of this is something that a lot of kind of, you know, whatever you want to call them, like leftists, like radicals, whatever. It's something that they all know. But it was the way that he framed it and the way that he said it as like, just became piercingly obvious, right? And even the people who are outside of that sphere like couldn't help but think, "Oh yeah, what the hell is that about?" And then I guess the last sort of two things that I think are really important to say about David before I stop this very incomplete history is he was really like one of the few kind of active supporters of the what's called the Rojava Revolution, which took place in northern Syria. And just in case sort of you haven't heard of it before, it's kind of one of the few things to come out of the sort of uprisings of 2011, the sort of Arab Spring, that really like concretely manifested a serious alternative to, you know, the nation state and to capitalist society. And it took years and years to build, right? It didn't just happen overnight. It didn't even start really in 2011. But yeah, he was a one of the few supporters of this thing, which was, Kurdish people basically building a radical democratic society in one of the like harshest bits of the planet, a part of the world engulfed in civil war, and they built it regardless, a kind of radically feminist, ecological society. And yeah, not many people were paying attention, and he, you know, would write about it in The Guardian and, you know, would like just constantly shine a light on it, which I think, I think is really kind of just admirable. It's just great. And then we got to know him, I guess, through our work with Extinction Rebellion, which was a kind of uprising of people in 2018,
2019. Both, right?
Yeah.
Still ongoing.
We met in there, and you know, I guess it sort of speaks to the, like, he could just, you know, cross all of these different camps, different political groups, and he was really at home there, and like spoke at events, and so that's, there you go, that's my brief history.
Nice, thank you, Greg. Should we maybe take it to a musical break now?
What are you going to play?
Yeah, what do you guys want to call something out?
We can have a little bit of this song by Alice Coltrane. This might be a like nice way of easing us into the chat. It's called Going Home.
Right. So one of the things that David Graeber wrote that I think is my personal favorite, or like maybe had the most personal impact on me, is kind of smaller in his overall body of work. It's just one kind of one-off article called On Flying Cars or something like that. It's in the Baffler. If you look up David Graeber, Flying Cars, you can find the whole article. I thought it was really impactful to me, at least, because, you know, I don't know how much the audience knows about this, but I have a background in engineering. I'm not working as an engineer, but I may sometime in the future, depending on how things go. But David Graeber, not an engineer, an anthropologist, but he has this great essay about like the way that technological development happens and sort of the forces that shape it, and like what technology is used for in like, you know, American or like Western society. So I guess like the big, the sort of hook of the essay is he starts talking about how like when he was a kid, you know, in the, I guess, 60s or 70s, there was this idea that like all these technological changes were going to be coming in the future. You know, like you would use the year 2000 sort of as this idea of like sometime long in the future when we'd have like flying cars, obviously from the title of the essay, but like, you know, space travel in general. I'm struggling to think of other examples, but you know, the future was wide open for technological change. And he's writing this essay in, I think, 2016. And so he starts it by saying, look, like none of this has happened, you know, in terms of what's changed since the 1960s, we have like cell phones and the internet, but hardly any like real technological change at all. You know, like everything that was promised to us by this like society that we were living in 60 years ago or so hasn't come about. So the essay is sort of trying to analyze like why that's happened, you know, why this gap between what we thought was possible, what we thought we could achieve and what we have achieved is so large. So first he just starts talking about like what drives technological change. So one of the kind of obvious but surprising how large of an impact it has. One of these points is that pretty much all of the technological development that was happening in the late 20th century or the second half of the 20th century in America was due to either trying to sustain a consumer economy or competition with the Soviet Union. So things like television as a consumer object, you know, all of the appliances that like saved work in the home, plastics and all the sort of products that they make possible, that always like came into being. Maybe it saves a little bit of labor, maybe it makes your life a bit easier, but it's more there just to drive this like consumer economy that that America had and I mean still has, but just to keep people buying things, you know, and cycling their money around the economy. The second thing was to compete with the Soviet Union. So the space race is like the prime example of this, something that like had no purpose whatsoever, like in the grand scheme of things, you know, like we didn't need to go to the moon. We didn't like need to send satellites out of the solar system. The reason that we did that was to sort of show that we were better than the Soviet Union, sort of just for purely propagandistic reasons. To sort of prove this idea that the free market was the way to a better life. And so he goes on to talk about how that's not even like this idea of the free market producing all of this technological change isn't actually true. Like what we do now in terms of technological research is, it's not really the free market. It's most often carried out by like large bureaucratic organizations, often government, if not like massive business, and even more often the military. The technology that's being developed, you know, it's not going to like better the lives of average people. It's going to support the ends that the people carrying it out want it to do. So if it's the military, obviously those technologies are going to have military ends. And if it's, you know, a large corporation or the government, it's often going to have the goals of those bodies in mind, which may or may not align with the goals of like average people. I guess I'm going a bit long, but so the other problem, I guess, is that regardless of like what research is being carried out, it's being carried out in a very bureaucratic manner. And I think we can get into this more. Bureaucracy is one of David Graeber's like big enemies. He sees it as sort of like the source of pretty much all evil in the world. And I don't think that's like too big of an exaggeration. He's got a good bit about how the whole point of the left since like the French Revolution is just fighting against bureaucracy. And we can get more into that later. So scientists and engineers today are working under such a degree of like bureaucratization and paperwork that like they sort of have to prove that what they're experimenting with is going to work before they can even do it, which means that there's no time to like you know, play around with things and like have experiments that you don't know what's going to happen, which is where all of the big technological breakthroughs come in the past come from. And so then the areas we see the most development in are then like information technology. You know, I mean, when we say technology today, what we're talking about is just information technologies like computers, cell phones, like applications on those devices. So our entire view of like what technology is has been like greatly narrowed. So either information technology or like medicine and like medical technology. And both of these are technologies that are used, that are like can be used primarily to like surveil and control populations rather than like liberate them. Especially because, you know, medical advances, especially in America, are not accessible to the most people unless you like come from a certain economic bracket. And so, yeah, like basically the point of the article is to say that what we should be looking for in terms of technological change is what he calls poetic technologies, like what you could also call like moonshots, you know, like something that you have no idea if it's going to work or like how to do it. But if you just give people the time and resources, you know, to try and achieve it, you know, something will come out of it. You can't predict what, but the nature of technology now, you know, prevents us from ever getting close to any of that.
I love that idea of the moonshot. I think that's kind of how he saw social change happening generally. So like more than like just technological innovation, like just sort of, yeah, innovation about how we live together and what kind of like social orders we live under. I think about this really lovely quote that kind of sums up his whole ethos for me is something about how he's not so interested in coming up with like the blueprints for the perfect society as he is interested in thinking about what conditions are going to make them possible.
He's got this really great bit that actually it's related both to what you were saying about politics and what he was saying about technology as well, where he talks about the imagination. And I think this example is really good because it shows how he can take like a very simple idea, but then like back it up with this kind of academic rigor and sort of, I don't know, he can like open like a whole world from just like one little like phrase. So he talks about imagination and he's like, today we think of imagination as like something that's like kind of unreal, like impossible. You know, imagination is like what children have when they like play around with their toys. But he talks about how the origin of the phrase was actually sort of like an intermediate space between like abstract reason and like the real world in like, I don't know, Renaissance times. It was like sort of a part of the process of reasoning was like forming the image of the thing that you wanted to create and then creating it. So it's like very much like in and of this world. So like a politics of the imagination isn't one that's just like, you know, unreal and like not able to be achieved, but one which is like the act of thinking it is the act of creating it, you know, which I think is kind of inspirational idea.
Yeah, that really makes me want to just like move swiftly into some of his thoughts and ideas about I guess anarchism really, and like, I don't know, social theory or something. Do you feel like, can we do that? Can I do that?
Yeah,
you go for it.
You got no rules on the late night escape from noise show.
Yeah, I guess your like cliche understanding of anarchism, which is fairly like widely held, is the sort of like balaclava wearing Molotov cocktail throwing kind of like just person that wants to wreak chaos. And I never really thought about anarchism much more beyond that before reading David Graeber. Maybe also like Noam Chomsky did a bit to like break that illusion, but David Graeber mostly. And yeah, I feel like there's a lot to say. But what you were saying about the imagination, I think leads quite nicely into his kind of firm conviction that people, humans, are so much more capable than we're allowed to be right now. Like, we have so much more kind of capacity for looking after each other, for dreaming, imagining, creating, doing, than the society in which we live allows. And yeah, a big part of that is bureaucracy. But it's also inequality and kind of other forms of oppression. And so, yeah, the kind of anarchist, I don't know, ideal that he really has done so much to perpetuate is about freedom. And freedom is a really ugly word now, right? Because it's so synonymous with kind of like freedom to just like buy whatever the fuck you want, freedom to like destroy the planet. Freedom from any kind of tradition or any kind of established meaning. And it's kind of like, I don't know, but I feel like he was doing so much to try and reclaim this idea of
Also in America, at least, like, freedom is, it's sort of viewed as like a right-wing value, you know. It's
yeah,
people think of it as like freedom, like from society, freedom like from obligations to other people. But yeah, I think like he does such an important job of like reclaiming that word, because I think freedom is like, it's one of like the most basic human desires and needs, you know.
Yeah,
let it be co-opted in these ways.
Yeah, no, totally. And there's so much more in anarchism as well about kind of like cooperation and the possibility for humans to like work together and work together without being coerced into working together. So the free market and kind of other sort of forms of organizing hierarchically assumes that the only way humans are going to like do things for the greater good is if they're kind of forced into doing it, you know, if they have to earn a paycheck, or if they have to avoid getting, you know, whatever, locked up in prison. And his ideal and the kind of anarchist ideal, like way beyond this, just like chaos driven, whatever, is about enabling, like the conditions that are, you know, will enable genuine cooperation and humans really working together. And just as an aside, I feel like, you know, in this moment, when we've got this like the biggest collective action problem ever about how we are relating to the planet, thinking about how humans cooperate and can work together, I feel like it's it's the most important question, right?
It's funny, just in like, just jumping in, like having, looking at like debt and like some of the stuff that he talked about there, he tries like quite hard to dismiss the idea of like a barter economy coming before a market economy. And this idea that like in a barter economy, like you'd have trade chickens for one cow and it would just be like very messy and confusing, where it's like one person going over to the next person's house and saying like, here's my chickens, here's your cow. But like how that just would never really happen, because presumably like if they're neighbors, like they would know each other, they have like, you know, a dependency on each other in some way. It's impossible to sort of not be in each other's debts, because they're part of this like community, or they rely on each other in society. And like what a system based on exchange does is it kind of just like cuts those like ties and that trust that people have on one another. I guess at the same time, like alienating people from their labor does that as well, but it's like from themselves and each other's. But yeah, that to me is quite an important part that like comes through in debt. It's just trying to get rid of that idea of this like, yeah, bogus kind of barter economy that was then replaced by market economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also, I think he brings this up also, is the idea of like this barter economy is like kind of inherently ridiculous. And part of the reason that it exists as an idea, like you think about it always at like the beginning of your like Econ 101 class.
And yeah,
it's presented in opposition to the market economy to say like, look how ridiculous things used to be. Like you had to get like, if you didn't have chickens, you couldn't get any bread because the bread guy needed your chickens or something like that. In the beginning of debt, he does a really good job of showing that like, oh, that's not true at all. That's just a caricature that's used to support like the ability of the market economy. Yeah.
I guess the other thing I wanted to say about anarchism is that it really probably shouldn't be called anarchism as such, because it's not the same as it's not as kind of exclusive as being a conservative or being a socialist, or it's like, it's not so much this big overarching theory about how the world works, which is that kind of maybe what Marxism is. There's like this kind of really stupid divide between Marxists and anarchists on the left, right? And it's kind of this like famous schism, right? And I feel like this is one of the beautiful things about David. He basically just like refused to accept that divide. He was like, anarchism and Marxism aren't opposed to each other because they're totally different things. You know, Marxism is a kind of revolutionary analysis of the world, and anarchism is a kind of an ethic practice, a thing that you do. So you can easily be both. And yeah, I guess just to talk more about like that practice, like anarchism, or like if you're kind of, you know, trying to live and to do anarchism, it matters what you do. Action and practice is the thing that makes the world and shapes the world. And I guess I've been really like drawn to that because I don't know, maybe I'm jumping around a little bit here, but kind of like, you know, it's easy to feel really disillusioned by kind of academia and intellectualism and stuff because there's a whole world of complicated ideas and they don't always feel like they're like shaping the world. Like in uni, I kind of did a combination of sociology and anthropology and such. And like was just left with this feeling of like real, just, you know, like detachment from the world and a kind of alienation, if you like, you know, just reeling out these essays and whatever. To stumble upon David Graeber and his work, you know, kind of revealed that actually it doesn't have to be that way. And it's not even as though he's saying, you know, fuck the academy, just focus on like practical action, because he would bring things together rather than like push them apart, you know, rather than like divide stuff and like keep people having to choose between two goods. He'd say, no, you can have both. And I think demonstrating really like amazingly how to be a kind of, you know, person who's thinking and caring about the world, but isn't kind of locked up in an ivory tower, but is like engaged in kind of practical action.
I think that's really true. One of the things that's always struck me about pretty much anything that he talks about or writes about is you get this like overwhelming sense of like, I don't know, like a moral authority. Like he really feels like someone who has values and like sticks to them, like no matter what, which is like so rare to find in like academics or like media personalities like whatsoever. And like everything, I mean, you were saying that like maybe you're going a bit like off track, but like all of his stuff is centered around this like same like moral core, and like anarchism is at the center of it. You know, like you were saying, it's not really a political ideology. And I think that that's really true. Like what it is, it's a commitment to like values of like freedom and democracy, and also like fun, you know, just like human pleasure and human enjoyment. Like that's really what it's all about. And it's about getting to that, however we need to get to it. But it's really about those like core, like sort of moral, like human values, you know?
Definitely. I also think, just to jump in with like another few words to throw in, is like compassion, love, and care. And like care is like something that David Graeber talks a lot about in relation to jobs and like what we value and the labor we care about. And I think we should come on to that maybe later, but that I think that's definitely something that is central to Sim Virtue's work, this idea of care. And that comes through his personality as well. Just like a caring, like fun individual that you, it's just such a pleasure to be with or to like read as well. You just like hear his voice coming through and it feels like he cares about stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's warm. I was gonna say, speaking of fun, shall we listen to a song?
Yeah, we absolutely should. George, you wanna pick something up?
I mean, 9 to 5 is a pretty fun song.
All right, so we got 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton. You're listening to Escape from Noise on WCBN FM. Hope you stick around. We got more David Graeber talk coming up after this.
stumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping. Folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Shatter. You're just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. In the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in and the tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and you never get the credit.
Gathers is Washtenaw County's food rescue and food bank program. Every day throughout the year, we fight hunger where we live. Call us at 761-2796 to find out how you can volunteer, how you can donate money, how you can donate food. Call us at 761-2796 to find out the role you can play in fighting hunger.
Hey, here we are. You're listening to Escape from Noise on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. We got a little special edition, the Boys Brain Club. We're talking David Graeber. We're talking anarchy. We're talking changing the world, if you're just joining us. What are we talking about now, though, specifically?
We were going to talk about bullshit jobs, right?
That's right. Yeah. We're talking bullshit jobs.
Everyone knows them. Maybe everyone's got one.
Everyone's got one.
You should do, if David Graeber's right. Yeah, I guess like Greg mentioned that earlier. He said like around 60% of people think that their job isn't worthwhile or it doesn't contribute to society. Might have just pulled that out of the air, but yeah, it sounds it's a significant proportion of people think that their job is worthless. And it's like, well, why are we doing it then? Like, and it's like this ideology kind of work. And he talks about it in Debt as well, because I actually haven't read Bullshit Jobs, just like, you know, heard about it quite a lot. But it's like this Puritan idea, like around the Reformation in like 1600 or something, of like work being valuable in of itself, and it like being very disciplinary. And if you're not doing anything, then you're just basically a bad person and should be punished in some way by God or by the state or by your parents. Yeah, and so that it also shouldn't be fun. He talks about it in this way that like for people who actually get enjoyment out of their job, like they shouldn't do, and you should get paid less there for, like because of it, or like the fun is something that you're like, yeah, like that's kind of effectively your pay. Like as if you're a teacher, you know, you're doing it because you love it and therefore you shouldn't get paid more.
Or even a nurse, like,
yeah,
especially, yeah,
it's obviously like ridiculous. And I guess why that touches me particularly and Greg as well, as we've both kind of worked together in a company that feels very much like this kind of bullshit job, which is basically kind of like, he has like categories for various bullshit jobs, and I haven't got the list with me now, but there's like box tickers, there's kind of like, I guess, people who just send emails and push, like send them between people. Like we are, in my personal experience, the kind of jobs that we're doing or that I did was like kind of consultations, which is a pretty stripped back, like, yeah, bullshit version of democracy that makes people feel like they have a say. But the decision's already been made, and they're basically just like, they're like governmentally imposed, you have to do them to get a kind of sign off from the public that they're allowed to build some kind of infrastructure or move a hospital here or move the services for hospital here or there.
Like the classic bureaucratic thing where instead of like actually trying to bring in the public and bring in sort of democracy, they just bring in the appearance of it, you know, but then like take people's time up in just like enormous amounts producing that appearance, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. And he like talks about it in one of his things about how like, you know, David and I also, we do it all the time, you know, you're chatting to someone at a party, obviously not in this last year, but like you chat to people and like we're not really excited about our jobs. It's like, yeah, you know, we do this thing, we write a report about it, and then we send it to this person, and that's kind of it. So like the work is very much just reporting on something, and like it takes away like valuable time that could be invested in doing things that actually benefit society. And it's also just painstakingly like, or soul destroying and crushing, you know, sitting there day in, day out, doing like categorizing data into more kind of general codes that then can be written about.
Yeah.
Greg, yeah, go on.
It's like we get, you know, like hundreds of incredibly impassioned comments about why they shouldn't destroy England's like last fucking forest for this new road, like, and the job that George and I have is to categorize all of those comments, which really means take all of that like complex like passion and reduce it to like it's totally stripped back argument so that it can become a number in a report that nobody looks at anyway, and that's our democracy.
Yeah. Not just is that democracy, but that's like the society that we've built, for which like in order just to like feed yourself, like so many people are having to do this kind of like life draining work, you know? And I don't know, that's like one of David Graeber's strengths, I think, is that taking these like in like obvious things, like 60% of society like knows that what they're doing is just like pointless or like deceptive, but he's able to write about it in this way that like points out the root causes and sort of like the I don't know how clear and like obvious the problem is and how like clearly and obviously it could be solved if we would just like get together, you know.
Yeah, I hope it gets picked up more. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was gonna share my my most bullshit job that I ever had, which was for a summer I was working at this it was like a military contractor, like providing parts for like military airplanes. And it was at the place where they built them. And so what my job was to do is there was like a, there was a way, it was actually the testing of the already built modules. And this is, it's already a boring story, but that's kind of the point. It's just like how life-numbingly dull this job was. And so for each like test routine, there would be a set of instructions on how to like take this part and put it into the testing machine and like run the test. And like every single part was like painstakingly laid out because it was a government like military contractor, and they had to be able to show government military contracting like auditors that they were doing everything right. So they had to have the instructions there. But then for whatever reason, the instructions would get updated maybe like once a week. Maybe more often, maybe less often, but every time there was like the slightest change made, my job was to print out the new like 300-page document, throw out the old 300-page document, which was usually only like a week old, so like incredibly wasteful on top of everything else, but then just print this out and put it in its place. and just like do that constantly, just like printing things out and putting them there. And like no one would ever look at them because the changes were only ever like very minor changes and people knew how to do it anyways, but it had to be there just in case some like auditor would come by, which happened like once a year, once every 2 years or something like that.
I remember, sorry, George, did you want to come in? No, you're good.
No, I've got something to come back on, but go ahead.
I remember when I was, yeah, it's funny how David's sort of like threaded different parts of my life. So like this experience in university just kind of like pretty numbed out to like alienated, you know, academia. And then leaving uni and going to London where I met you all, and then working this sort of weird job of George. And I remember one of my first days in this new job, my job was to pull staples out of just like hundreds of these handwritten consultations. I had to pull them out so that they could all be scanned in, you know, and I was in this like tiny room. And it's hilarious to think back on now, because I was literally listening to a podcast with David Graeber in this tiny room. And I remember this overwhelming feeling of like, I don't know, just comfort and, you know, like support and kind of like possibility. I don't know, just this sense that like, okay, I'm not crazy. This is fucking stupid. What's going on?
He's talking about me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was fine, because then Greg would come into the coffee room and we'd talk about it. But yeah, I feel like just in terms of when Paul was talking, it reminded me, when both of you, I guess, like of just how it also, like it relates back to the Flying Kaya's essay of like, hopefully like that, or the fear, I guess, that like technology will replace human jobs and then that will like then be liberated from them and be free. But in actuality, like they haven't done that and we're working more than we ever have done. And then right. Also the jobs that we're doing just destroys our imaginations, so that like by the time we're finished with them, we have the money to like, you know, barely, or just to survive and eat and stuff. But then you're just so tired that you can't really use your imagination in a creative way, like that is fun or whatever. And that's just like this double sort of hitting, like horribleness.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's one of the things he does really well, is like validate those things that like, I guess, like common sense, or like what goes for common sense in like the US or the UK would say like, oh, just like, yeah, that's making a living, you know, like you just got to put up with it. You just got to put up with like a life draining job and then like an hour and a half of commuting every day. That's just like the way the world is. And like, I think like the central question of David Graeber's work is like, why couldn't it be otherwise? Like, why is it that we've convinced ourselves like that this is the only way that things can be?
It is funny actually, because I was talking to my dad over Christmas, and like, you know, as you do with when parents, it often goes to the subject of jobs, and he was saying how like, you know, for him work was never something he was passionate about. It was purely a means through which he could have a family and like provide for them, and like, yeah. So he lives very much within this paradigm, right? But it was a way to get a salary that could then allow him to do things that, you know, were perceived mm-hmm. as being free, I guess.
Yeah. It's I think the other important thing about bullshit jobs and that idea is that like the people who have a bullshit job are producing things that no one really needs as well. So it's related to this general idea about the kind of consumer society where work mm-hmm. is to produce things so that we can all consume them. And the people, like the other sort of, you know, 40% of people who don't think they have a bullshit job, they're not really, they're often like the working classes, and they're not really involved in producing new things. They're involved in the maintenance of old things. And actually like, this is where an enormous amount of the like social value that we experience on our every day comes from, but it's not reflected in kind of economic value. So we don't have an economic system that values care or maintenance or whatever. And I remember he kind of called Occupy the revolt of the caring classes, you know, because it was teachers and nurses and these people who are doing that. And it's true, like you know, you make a cup once, but you clean it like 1,000 times. You know, that's the real labor to life. And if we had an economic system that reflected that, then we wouldn't be producing so much shit and throwing it out and ruining our like environment. And, you know, we'd be looking after things and each other. Imagine?
I can't imagine. My imagination has been closed off entirely.
I can see a song in your playlist that's called Try to Be Joyful. Is that something you want to
know? Oh, I'm saving that for the end.
All right, cool.
But what about this is a fun one. The reason I included this song is because like I was saying, I think at the center of David Grable's like moral like universe is just like pleasure and like having fun and just like being joyful, I guess, but I'm not gonna play the joyful song. This one's called Beef Jerky by Sibo Mato, and it's just like an all around like fun, funny song. So hope you enjoy. Jerky by Sibo Mato. If you're just joining us, this is Escape from Noise, live on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. We've got a couple special guests here tonight in to discuss David Graeber, his legacy, his ideas. But we've been doing that for almost an hour now. My question for you guys, Greg and George, is what can we do about it? You know, we've had some lovely ideas that we've discussed, but it just seems like this global system of neoliberal capitalism, you know, it's just making it impossible for me to really change anything or do anything, you know? Like, we voted for Corbyn, we voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary, maybe we even voted for Joe Biden in the general election, but, you know, things don't seem to be changing at all. So what can we do with all this stuff, you know?
Cancel all the debt.
Yeah, if only I were the U.S. treasurer, then I'd do that. But
I think this is a fun turn for our conversation to take, because like we have been saying that, you know, David Graeber was all about like action and practice, and well, we've just been kind of talking about his idea. So the answer to your question, Paul, is direct action.
Okay, remember that one, direct action. You can cross that off on your bingo cards if you're playing along.
So what is direct action, I hear you ask? I don't know, do either of you know? What's direct
action? I hope one of you guys knows.
I feel like it's like you have a problem, and instead of like calling the plumber and getting him to come and fix it, or getting them to come and fix it, but you fix it yourself.
Nice.
DIY social change.
Yeah.
Go on, Greg.
About kind of self-reliance. Yeah. I guess I think of it in terms, in like contrast to other ways of trying to create social change. So like, instead of petitioning someone else to do something, you go and you try and do it instead. So, you know, instead of asking your local council, like, can we create a community garden? You just dig up your local park and you start planting things. And then
guerrilla gardening.
Yeah. I guess this translates into kind of sort of the world of civil disobedience, I guess, because it's about not waiting for permission. Not even really asking for forgiveness, but just doing what you think is right. And yeah, he wrote this book, Direct Action and Ethnography, which is a big like brick of a thing. And it's an ethnographic account. And ethnography, by the way, is just a kind of tool of anthropology where you go and you live with, you kind of do the thing that you're studying, right? So traditionally, you know, you go and you live with, you know, maybe just a different community to yourself. And that's the way that you understand that group of people, rather than reading, you know, whatever, histories about them, whatever. You go and you experience it. So direct action and ethnography is David Graeber in the kind of direct action world in the kind of late 90s, trying to organize big shutdown of I think it's the World Trade Organization meeting in Quebec. And yeah, it's like there's loads to say about it, really. He kind of explores, you know, anarchism and direct action and some of the like tensions around trying to be in solidarity with marginalized groups and the question of kind of non-violence, which always comes up, question of consensus, which I find really interesting. And I think we've kind of come from Extinction Rebellion, which have this interesting like version of consensus. But he really like gives a detailed description of it, which I think lots of people have picked up on. But in essence, consensus really is just making a decision in a group where you don't force anybody to do anything they don't want to do. It's really simple. Where you basically give everybody the right to stop a decision being made if they don't think that they can live with it. And oftentimes we think of consent, like our association with this is kind of like, you know, endless meetings and like the kind of reaching the lowest common denominator. But in this book, I feel like he shows actually how what happens in consensus and in deliberation isn't this kind of endless compromising. But it's actually people being able to learn, people being able to change their minds about things, people being able to kind of grow as a group and explore all the options, people really having power over what happens. And he's like, this doesn't really ever happen in everyday life, in America at least. He's like, you know, the closest we come to this is trying to order a pizza with your mates and trying to choose what toppings to go on. And he has this really good point, which is if people's ideas mattered, you know, if they could really like impact the world, you know, stop a decision from being made, if they really could genuinely participate, then they would end up having good ideas. They would have to, they would feel like responsible for something. And he's like, the reason that we have this rise of like, just like bigotry and like outlandish kind of thinking is because people's ideas don't actually matter. What do you think about that?
Not just people's ideas don't matter, but like the sort of idea that they don't matter as like people entirely. You know, I think that's like this sort of like unacknowledged, like, I mean, not to go back again to the 2016 election, but I mean that was at the center of
a referendum, if you like.
Exactly. Good thing we have these parallels so we can talk about both at the same time. But people, whether in the middle of America or like the north of England or whatever, could feel that not just like their ideas but like their opinions and like them as people just like did not matter to the political process whatsoever, and that leads to these sort of chaotic or like unexpected or destructive outcomes, and I think one thing I wanted to add also is that, like, I guess consensus decision making, I feel like, gets a bad rap, especially among like certain parts of the left. But like, I think one of the reasons that it's difficult when it is difficult is because so many people from like so many different backgrounds are coming together. If you think about something like Occupy, like that drew in like so many people that had just like no like exposure to like the consensus background, like decision making process, or like very different opinions about like what should be done. And so it was like a very like extreme case, you know. If you think about just like what the ideal would be, would just sort of be like this in a community setting, right? Like with your neighbors, with like people you know and are like responsible to in everyday life, it becomes a lot easier, you know, than this sort of like, you know, the stereotype of like the 6-hour meeting or whatever.
Yeah. And you know, it takes practice and work as well. Like, we've kind of had all those skills, you know, just like kind of gutted from our social fabric.
Yeah.
There's a lot of unlearning to do, definitely. Like, instead of trying to be like proven right or to prove yourself right, to just be able to listen to people. And also, like, as you said, Paul, like coming into contact with people from different backgrounds than yourselves. Like, I feel like we live in such like segregated society that like you're so unlikely to come into contact with someone that like has a different experience than you are. And so then you're like confronted with someone who definitely has, you know, like all these various other things, and you need to be able to like listen to that instead of like, you know, hammering through your opinion and like how you think things should be.
I mean, this is a common experience, right? Every time politics comes up, I mean, we've just come out of like, you know, Christmas, New Year's, going home to family, and I feel like that's when it gets really clear around the dinner table that there's something fucking weird about the way that we talk about politics, and like there's a certain just total inability to listen. So yeah, you're onto something.
You're listening to WCBN-FM Ann Arbor.
Definitely. Another part. Do you want to play a song? Or?
One thing I wanted to bring up, actually, I'll play a song and then I'll bring up the point I was gonna do before. How about that? And actually, I realized the song I should have played before we were talking about bullshit jobs is this song by Dan Reeder. Can I slip it in right now?
Yeah.
All right. This is Work Song by Dan Reeder.
I got all the fucking work I need. 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 I got all.
1 in 6 seniors faces the threat of hunger, and millions more live in isolation. Drop off a hot meal and say a quick hello. Volunteer for Meals on Wheels by donating your lunch break at AmericaLetsDoLunch.org. This message brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. I've been working in this factory for now 15 years. All this time I watched my woman drowning in a pool of tears. And I've seen a lot of good folk die, had a lot of bills to pay. I'd give the shirt right off of my back if I had the guts to say, take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. My woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. Well, that foreman, he's a regular dog. The line boss, he's a fool. Got a brand new flat top haircut. Lord, thinks he's cool. One of these days I'm gonna blow my top, and that sucker, he's gonna pay. Lord, I can't wait to see their faces when I get the nerve to say, take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. My woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. I ain't working here no more. Take this job and shove it.
You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. That was Take This Job and Shove It from Johnny Paycheck. Before that, Work Song from Dan Reeder. But it's not only about the music tonight. If you're just joining us, we're going to be talking about David Graeber and his life, his ideas, his works. I think we're well into the works section of the evening. Just talking about direct action and how David Graeber sort of tried to put these ideas of anarchism, of freedom, of like human liberty into action. And the thing that I wanted to bring up, actually, we were talking before about direct action. I think the examples that you were using were like, I don't know, sort of like community, sort of like mutual aid sort of things, like, I don't know, like planting some gardens or something. And that's part of it. That's like what you might call like, I don't know, a positive direct action, like trying to produce something that you think ought to exist. But the other side of direct action, and maybe like the more famous one, like what people think about when they think about direct action, is what you might call like a negative direct action, maybe like trying to stop something from happening that you have no other like recourse to stopping, you know? And like the classic example of this would be like the anti-globalization like protests in the late 90s and early 2000s, which like you were saying, are like the subject of the direct action book that David Graeber wrote. And of course, we're all too young to really have participated, but That's part of the reason that the book is such a great document, because those things are like that leads into Occupy Wall Street, leads into like the environmental protests that are taking place like even now. So I thought maybe like, do you guys want to talk about like how that kind of direct action like takes place, how David Graeber's like ideas are related to it, you know? Maybe we could like walk through the a sort of like general overview of like a day in the life of a direct action.
A day in the life of a direct action. I mean, one thing I'd say is like when I was reading Direct Action, I think like it feels super personal, right? Like it starts with like him meeting a friend in a cafe, and there's this sort of dead time, or like time that you're sort of, there's this nervous energy before something happening, or maybe there's something that needs to be decided, where you're going to get picked up and where you're going to get dropped off, and just all these little small logistical things that all come into it. And that's something that I can definitely relate to, of like, there's a lot of sort of standing around and sitting around in direct actions, and then like, these very intense moments that very like quickly happen, and then before you know it, sort of too late. But that sort of comes across a lot in reading that book for me. But yeah, go on, someone else.
I'm gonna have to be careful not to talk too much. I like the framing of like a sort of a direct action to stop something and a direct action to do something. I think it's really interesting the ones that do both.
Okay.
Like squatting is a form of direct action. And it's, you know, it's stopping people from, you know, like neglecting buildings, and it's stopping the things that kind of contribute to a housing crisis. It's kind of like speculative real estate, but it's also creating space and like creating kind of community and creating a kind of alternative. So we've squatted together, actually. Am I allowed to say that?
I think so. What's the statute of limitations on that?
And and you know, there's this like, I don't know, there's something, it's kind of adrenaline to all of it, right? There's this kind of like, you know, fear of breaking rules, and this like exhilaration of being able to, and this sense of confidence and power, right? Like, I mean, we lived in London, and London is a fucking overwhelming metropolis, and you just feel like a tiny, worthless piece of shit. And to be able to like reclaim a building, you know, and there are thousands of empty buildings in London, to be able to reclaim one and use it for like really joyous things, you know, whether it's just us like cooking together, making meals, having people over, but we've also opened buildings to throw like amazing parties in, and to listen to music together. And should I start talking about MDMA again?
I think maybe let's leave that off of the subject matter. But yeah, I think like you brought this up before, but I really want to like drive this home, is like the essence of direct action is like sort of living as though you were already free, sort of like a calculated denial of like the laws and rules of society, but still like a denial nonetheless, you know. Because like, I mean, not to go back and repeat this again, but I think like it is at the center of like David Graeber and anarchism, and like all of this stuff we've been talking about, is like the idea of like freedom and like the human freedom to like pursue like enjoyment and like pleasure in life. And so direct action is sort of like the seizing of that from this like very unenjoyable like society that we've been placed in, I guess. Even though it might not last for a very long time, but like,
yeah.
One thing I think that's quite important that comes through direct action quite a lot is like the role of art and sort of performances, like throughout these actions, like in Seattle and in Quebec and various other bits in the book. And it kind of is like turning this like, I guess, ugly, like brutal kind of architecture of a city and like, yeah, beautifying it. And there's always that sort of stuff around in actions, like, I don't know, chalk or kind of performances and stuff. And that kind of then is, part of the action in itself, you know, it's a way of like, I guess, turning the violence of this veneer of buildings and then the police that are there and beautifying it, and that kind of like takes away their power. So that comes through quite a lot in direction, and that's stuff that we've all done together as well in actions that that we've been a part of. Like, I could, there's one good example that I actually was, we were walking, me and Paul together, I think, with David Graybeard. It was in Trafalgar Square during one of the XR rebellions, and we'd like set up all of this yarn around various sort of street poles, street lamps, and created a web of yarn between us and the police. And like, he writes about this in Direct Action. It's from an example, I can't remember exactly where. And yeah, just being like this really fun kind of creative, just like movement of all these people going with yarn all around the place, and then it creating this like fun barrier between the police and us. Yeah, that was quite a lot of fun.
I remember in, cause we got that from Direct Action, the book.
And yeah.
In the book, I think it was someone did that first with yarn, and it's great because it's actually kind of a pain in the ass to get through. Like, it sounds like it's a thin, simple thing, but it creates this really strong mesh, which is quite a nice sort of metaphor. And we're stronger together. And then later, somebody did the same thing, but with like steel sort of piano wire and like painted piano wire. And the police were like joking on their motorbikes, like kind of saying, you know, what that flimsy stuff, like we can literally go straight through it. And they revved up their engine, these two like badass like motor cops, and like went straight into
leather.
We're just like pulled off of their bikes, right?
That unfortunately didn't happen when we did it.
No, we're a bit tamer.
Yeah. I was thinking, like, I don't know, maybe this is, I don't know too much about the Middle Ages, but where I'm going with this is, I mean, from what I understand, we used to have, like, throughout the year, like, several, like, sort of, like, feast days or, like, holidays where, like, everybody could just sort of, like, let loose and sort of create their own, like, create a celebration, like, communally, like, from amongst themselves. And there's really, like, no space for that I can think of. Like, sure, you've got like music festivals, but those have all been like corporatized. Like, I don't know, you can like go to a club or something, but then like you can't really like create it yourself. You can have like a party in your living room, but it's not the same as like bringing everybody from like your neighborhood or your community together to like create a party yourself. And that's like kind of one of the great things about Direct Action, is like, outside of any sort of like larger political things, like trying to shut down a meeting of like the G7 or something, is just like getting people together to like have a good time in like a real like uninhibited way is like so important, you know?
Yeah. Like, and this is like what David does. He dispels these myths around activism, right? There's the myth that like, if you want to become an activist, you're going to have to like get used to some like long boring meetings where you're not going to get heard, or you're going to have to like start taking sides and become kind of like sectarian and whatever, and and also you're going to be bored and you're not going to have a good time. And he's like, you know, he like kind of shows that actually it's fun, and it's got to be fun, like, you know.
So people don't get burnt out. It's interesting you mentioned that though, Paul, because I was reading today in Debt, the first thousand years, like that it was in like the 15th century or the 1400s, when there was this like, that was like the perfect kind of golden heyday of peasants, because it was like after the Black Death, like after the plague, there was obviously loads of people died, and so there was like loads of work for people to have, so the wages just like increased massively, so people had more money and were able to spend it on more things and then didn't work as much. And then like what ended that, and it kind of relates back to like the work and like bullshit jobs, is like these Puritan like reformist like morals, then like made people feel bad for not doing work and started to like clamp down like massively with like, you know, religious like exigence, and then stop people from like having a good time. It's like that funny kind of snippet in the Middle Ages, you know, 15th century, where it was like a great, everyone having a great time. Revive that.
Yeah. And I mean, part of that is like the Puritans were like some of the early capitalists also. So like feudal society, like if you're a peasant, like you have at least like a secure place in society. Like if there's a bad harvest, like still you're probably gonna starve or whatever, but absent that, like you're the lord of your land, like owes you something as well. Like there's bonds like between like everybody around you, whereas like once the sort of like the cash nexus, or like once like money becomes like just like the medium of all sort of like social interactions, like all that stuff is just like severed, you know. So I forget where I'm going with this exactly.
Direct action.
sure. I was trying to do a David Graeber and bring in like some like really obscure ancient history that's like somehow oddly relevant, but I just can't do it as well.
Yeah. Right, it would have been relevant because you would have had access to the land and like being able to do stuff and like for your own subsistence on the land, and you wouldn't have been just like
right. Like you're tied to the land, which is like sort of like the big problem of peasantry, is like you're not free to move about, but then at the same time you have a right to be on the land, and like nobody can really kick you off. Like you can't leave, but nobody can kick you off at the same time. So, you know, yeah. But Greg, what were you going to say?
Well, I'm just thinking about your earlier question about, you know, direct action and thinking about, you know, our favorites. And I mean, yeah, it should mention, you know, like there's this word like prefigurative politics, which is kind of associated with direct action. And it basically means exactly what we've been saying, like starting to build the world that you want to live in. Don't wait for it to be given to you. And Occupy was a great example of that, right? Where they were practicing these forms of direct democracy. But there's this other really good example, which I wanted to just spend a second talking about. And it's like, it's bizarre how much we don't know about it. I think you could say that it's like the kind of biggest win for the environmental movement in Europe of the like of the decade. And we just like nobody really ever talks about it, and that's I think that's a good reason for that, and maybe we can get into that in a minute.
Is that the blocking of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline?
No, it's the blocking of an airport that was going to be built in France next to Nantes, right? And Nantes has one of the biggest airports in France already, and they were going to build another one next to it on farmland in a place called Notre-Dame-des-Landes. And, you know, they were going to do it in the 80s or even earlier than that, actually. And there was a long kind of standing campaign against it, right? The campaign in total was like 50 years old. And they took it to court. They fought like literally like over 100 legal battles and lost every single one of them. And it's 2008. There was this kind of moment where it was like they were going to lose, and they tried everything. The development company was buying up all of the farms. The farmers had sort of left. A lot of them had taken money, and it was bleak, right? And there were a few kind of really radical farmers, because it's a part of France that has a really radical history, right? And there's a few left who were just like, you know, desperate and willing to try anything. And they basically invited a bunch of squatters to come and live on the land to try and hold it and defend it. And what really, really did it, what really kind of shifted the balance of power, was there was this movement called climate camps that was basically occupying land. It's a little like what Reclaim the Power is. I don't know if people know about that now, but basically occupy the land, stop pieces of capitalist infrastructure from happening, try and build a movement that way. It's really direct action. Anyway, so Climate Camp came along to this patch of grass in France and in 2008 and held a week of, you know, festivals, parties, trainings, talks, workshops. And then at the end, there was this, you know, moment where they said, you know, we actually need people to live here. Like, do you want to stay? And loads of people did. And it turned into this mass occupation. We're talking like hundreds of people setting up communes in these old farmhouses and living together. There were sort of 70, 80 different distinct communes at a period of time over these like, you know, 3,000-4,000 hectares of land. I mean, fucking hell, it's cool, right? I mean,
yeah. No, absolutely.
And then they lived there and built up this kind of community, you know, trying to reclaim the commons, etc. And there were just like countless attempts to evict them, right? And the French government, you know, brought in kind of armored vehicles. They fired, you know, smoke grenades. They did just like, you know, an incredible amount to try and get them out. Anyway, I'm rambling a bit and going into the detail, but the short version of this is that they won, right? They like managed to like create this community of resistors. And 10 years later in 2018, Macron said, you know, okay, there won't be any airport, fine. Okay, so how does this relate to David Graeber? Well, it's a really good direct action. I went there in 2018 just to like see what it was like and what was going on. I interviewed some people who were there, and I remember them like talking about David Graeber. Anyway, I went back and like found these interviews, and I could share with you guys some of the, just some clips from them that reference David Graeber. I think they might be kind of interesting. What do you think? Is that okay?
For sure. Like, yeah, cool. Share the audio or like read it out loud?
I think I'll share the audio.
Okay.
Yeah, so you might have to stop doing that for a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
Great. So yeah, so these were two activists who were part of the original kind of, they're part of kind of lots of different social movements. And they're very much like artist activists as well, really interested in, yeah, what we've just been talking about.
Something that is, yeah, which is really difficult, but it's also because I also think very sincerely that we don't know how to deal with victory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it hardly ever happens. But really, it's like, you know, David Graeber wrote a really good article about that. Really? It's like, it's worth reading it.
I'll find it.
I can't remember what it's called, but if you say Graeber victory, whatever, it's like you'll find it. And he talks about the auto-globalization movement that is always described as a movement that, you know, petered out and just didn't win anything. And he's like, this is bullshit. It's like, actually, the WTO never recovered from the auto-globalization movement. And it's like, but we don't know how to think about victory because, and I think he's right in the sense that we keep shifting the goalpost. You know, and so you say, oh, you know, against the airport in its world, against the airport in its world. The moment the airport gets cancelled, yeah, but it was really against the world, you know, against its world. And so almost, you know, almost immediately for quite a lot of people was just that, oh, well, actually the airport doesn't matter. Mm. And so there were people who refused to talk about victory.
Wow.
And I was like, it is a fucking victory. It's not half enough, you know? It's like there's no doubt that this is not the victory,
right,
but it's a fucking victory.
Yeah.
And I really think that we don't know how to deal with it because it's never enough. Because no, we haven't brought down capitalism. Yeah, no, we haven't stopped climate change. Yeah. And there are still migrants that get tortured, you know, and it's like, and fascism is still rising. And it's like, yes, all of that. There's no doubt about that. We haven't had the victory because I don't think it will ever happen. It's like, but it is a victory.
Yeah, I just wanted to share that because I think, I don't know, it's kind of touching to see the way that David's like just relentless sort of positivity and like will to kind of affirm the amazing things that happens. Just supported all of these people because they had a hard time, you know, after they won. A lot of conflict emerged. And yeah, I think a big part of David's legacy is trying to create some positivity among activists and that.
Yeah, for sure. One thing that made me think about is the way that he writes about sort of like history and like very like deep history. Like George, the debt book that you have brought up a couple times goes back like 5,000 years. And he has this way of making like very ancient history like relevant to the present day and relevant to like social relations in the present day, which I think makes the like struggles that we're involved in seem a bit more like able to be dealt with, you know, because like if you only ever think about the present moment, it definitely seems like nothing's ever changing, like because you're so focused on like the immediate struggles and you can't see like in the context of like a generation or like a couple of generations. But when David Graeber like brings these like longer struggles and these like, you know, like sort of like ancient historical struggles of like the oppressed against people holding power. You can see that like there's no way that you're going to win everything right away. Like what's important is like those small victories, those small like moments of celebration and enjoyment.
Yeah, definitely. It makes me think like there's something that he said and then I wrote down. It says he calls for us to see ourselves as historical actors, as people who can make a difference in the course of our world events. And that's what like definitely comes across while reading Debt, because of like, as you say, like such this long like range of history and like how much things change in that time, but like also happen in a cyclical way. And that like it is possible, you know, like to write off debts or to like, you know, soften things or to put governments under certain pressure to you know, put certain policies that make things like, you know, softened or whatever. And or like with Corona now, it's like even more relevant with money all of a sudden just existing, or like being able to print more money in order to like, you know, solve the crisis at the moment, or like, you know, go somewhere in towards solving the crisis at the moment. Not that it does a very good job of it, but yeah, definitely that kind of like, yeah, I guess that hope that we, if like we all do come together as a group of people, like we can have an impact.
And then the one thing that I wanted to add also is sort of like to bring that sort of like historical view into like the present moment, because I think we mentioned this at with like the biography that we were talking about earlier of David Graeber, but like he was kind of present at like a lot of like the sort of crucial moments in the evolution of like the West in America especially, but like also like the UK and Europe, like particularly I wanted to start by talking about like sort of the end of the 90s and this anti-globalization like protest, because like I think, I mean, I wasn't alive then. I don't know too much about this, but like this sort of global left was sort of, the Soviet Union was like the big like figure of the global left, this sort of like idea that like another way of organizing society was possible. And when that collapses in like 1990, you like, there was really like not much of an alternative for the left to like hold on to. Like it sort of had to create from scratch a sort of mode of opposing capitalism. And really like people talk about like the environmental movement in the US, but that was, I think, more of like a single issue sort of thing. I don't think it had like a real like vision for society, but like the anti-globalization movement was like maybe the first like real alternative to spring up after the fall of the Soviet Union. And David Graeber was like right there at the center of it, you know, has like maybe one of the best like accounts of that time in direct action. And then like, he's not satisfied with that. He like goes on and in 2011, you know, is one of like the leading figures of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which was like, again, like with like 9/11 and like the war on terror, I think that like suppressed a lot of like left energy, at least in America. I mean, but like, yeah, Britain took part in the war on terror as well. You know, I imagine it was kind of a similar thing. But like after the financial crash, like, again, it was clear that like some sort of opposition was needed, but that just like didn't exist like within the spirit of the times. And David Graeber was like right there at the creation of that like mode of opposition. I guess I don't know what I'm trying to say with this is like it is very hard to like be on the left and be like you know, active politically now, and it's easy to get discouraged, but David Graeber is so good at like finding the openings and finding the spots where you can like make change, or like, you know, make a little change that like has a domino effect and leads to more and more things. And I think that here's what I'm trying to say. This is why it's important to like know about David Graeber and like read some of his stuff, is because he's just like, he's got like a nose for it. You know, he knows where like the most important like fault lines in this just like unpenetrated, can you say that, unable to be penetrated, like cement wall of capitalism, is he's like finds the cracks in it and just like wedges his fingers in and like doesn't break the whole thing down, but just like opens it up a little bit, you know, more and more each time. So yeah, hope I wasn't going on too long, but that's I think
that was great. It reminds me of this quote. Can I share it with you?
Yeah, you sure can.
It's from this book, The Democracy Project, which is all about Occupy. And he basically says, much of our political culture, even our daily existence, makes us feel that events like Occupy are impossible. Indeed, he says, there is reason to believe that our political culture is designed to make us feel that way. And the result has a chilling effect on the imagination. So, which means that even those who, you know, like myself, organize much of our lives and most of our fantasies and aspirations around the possibility of such outbreaks of the imagination, were startled when such an outbreak actually began to happen. Which is why it's crucial to begin by underlining that transformative outbreaks of imagination have happened. They are happening. They surely will continue to happen again. The experience of those who live through such events is to find our horizons thrown open, to find ourselves wondering what else we assume cannot really happen actually can. Such events cause us to reconsider everything we thought we knew about the past. This is why those in power do their best to bottle them up, to treat these outbreaks of imagination as peculiar anomalies, rather than the kind of moments from which everything, including their own power, originally emerged. Nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Should we go to a musical break now?
Sounds like a good idea.
I've got a suggestion.
All right, what is it, Greg?
It might be highly inappropriate.
Okay.
I guess there's something about this song by Nina Simone, which is called Why, and in brackets, The King of Love is Dead. And she wrote it after Martin Luther King died. And there's something about the way that she's celebrating and mourning the loss of Martin Luther King. And I'm not saying that David Graeber is, you know, Martin Luther King by any stretch, yeah? I think David Graeber like offers a kind of different kind of leadership to Martin Luther King. You know, he was never leading any kind of formal organization or whatever. But we, you know, we don't have many leaders or figureheads or whatever, or heroes, if you like, you know, and I think David, you know, was kind of one. And anyway, so I thought this song might be nice to listen to. It's a beautiful song anyway. It's about Martin Luther King, not David Graeber, but, you know, there's parallels.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. So yeah, this is Why, subtitled The King of Love is Dead by Nina Simone.
Of course, this whole program is dedicated to the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King. You know that, anyway. Once upon this planet Earth lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow man. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to Earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead, love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread. With his mind
from his foes he did not hide. It's hard to think that this great man is dead. Oh yeah. Well, the murders never cease. Are they men or are they beasts? What do they ever hope to gain? Will my country too late for us all? And did Martin Luther King just die in vain? Cause he'd seen the mountaintop. And he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think, cause we're headed for the brink. Now that he is dead, he was for equality for all people, you and me, full of love and goodwill. Was not his way. He was not a violent man. Tell me, folks, if you can, just why was he shot down the other day? He'd seen the mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think and feel.
So nice. I think, yeah, Greg, what you were saying, I think maybe it's a bit much to say David Graeber is the modern day Martin Luther King.
I didn't say that.
Which you didn't say, you know.
You alluded to it.
But by saying that you weren't saying it, you made us think that maybe you might have been saying it. You know. But what that made me think about was... I guess one of the reasons that it's such a tragedy for me that David Graeber passed recently is that I think he was one of the very few like public intellectuals that was around on the left right now. Like in like every sense of the word, you know, like there's definitely like people who like frame themselves as public intellectuals, but nobody that could like really do the job in the way that David Graeber could, of like taking sort of like what might be a bit like abstract, like academic ideas, and like showing how they were like rooted in like everyday, like common life and experience, and making them like understandable to like regular people like me that have no idea about like anthropology or social theory or like politics or anything. And it's a tragedy because now he's not going to be able to write anymore or to like speak anymore or like to do that kind of work.
Anyway, to talk to more people like on the streets, I think that's what one of the main parts about it as well, is it kind of like dissolves that binary between the academia world kind of up here in an ivory tower, and then people like doing direct action on the streets. You know, it's like, no, like we can do both, you know, like they need to necessarily cross over and be created in both places, I guess, you know, like direct action within the institutions themselves, you know. And that's kind of what got him kicked out of Yale and had to come to the UK in the first
place. Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, he'll be sorely missed, definitely.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say one more thing about his, like, sort of work as, like, a public intellectual, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it's not the biggest point, but basically, like, there's this it's like a Russian literary critic or something. His name's, I think, Viktor Shlovsky, and he's got this idea where he says, like, the point of literature is to, like, estrange us from our, like, everyday world, to, like, make the world strange to us again, so we can see, like, the sort of beauty and, like, absurdity and, like, the richness of life that we, like, usually become numb to. And I think that's something that David Graeber's writing does, is to like take these like obvious sort of like numbing things, like the fact that 60% of people think their job is just like absolutely pointless, or like the fact that our entire like society is built around a system of like debt and finance that is just like absolutely absurd on the face of it, and then like making those sort of like very obvious things like new again, and making us like see the light around the edges. Like once you point it out, you can sort of hold it in your hands and then you can get around it in a way, but if you don't point it out, it just seems to be like totally enveloping you. So yeah, man, I hope I haven't sounded too much like an advertiser for the works of David Graeber, but I do think he's really great, you know. That's why we're doing this show.
He could have been an asshole as well. Like, it's important to say we don't know everything about him. But, you know, what we're doing here is you know, affirming the good qualities, you know.
Yeah. Explored
the entirety of that.
And most people that I know or, like, have, you know, watched any of the kind of memorials about David Graeber, they've all had a lot of positive things to say.
Yeah. I mean, that was the wild thing after he died. I mean, that's really when it kind of clicked for me what he meant. Because all of these people, I mean, I'm talking about the like British left, I guess, but still all of these people came out and said, you know, all these people from all kinds of different things. I remember people who kind of led the student movement against the increase in tuition fees, who were saying, you know, they based their meetings off of the consensus style that David Graeber had written about in Direct Action, you know, just these like all of these like threads and inspirations, and you know, the Corbyn project, right? Like David Graeber was hugely influential in kind of the policies that Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell were coming up with, and they were both like John McDonnell was like a friend of David Graeber, you know. It's just like to bridge the like, you know, what is called extra parliamentary politics, but really it's just like, it's politics, it's street politics, it's everyday politics. To bridge that and then the like, you know, the institutional kind of politics. Like it's just amazing.
I think maybe to close off, I thought it'd be nice to like, if we've done our job right and we've hooked the audience, maybe to like give a suggestion of like one thing to like start with David Graeber. Like something to read or like watch or something like that. I can start maybe. and give you two a bit of time to think about it. But what I would say, I brought up the flying cars essay, but there's actually another essay that comes in the same book or was published in the same book. The book's called The Utopia of Rules. And it's the first essay in the book, which is called Dead Zones of the Imagination, an essay on structural stupidity, does such a good job of like bringing all these like incredibly like, disparate elements together. Like he talks about bureaucracy, of course. He talks about anarchy and like the French Revolution and like the police state, and like brings all of these like different things together it's a wild ride, and I think it touches on a lot of like the main parts of his like his work or his ideas. So, do you guys have any suggestions maybe?
Yeah, I mean, struggling as well because I haven't really read that many essays of David Graeber. Like I've spent the last like couple of weeks like leafing through Debt, and like definitely enjoyed it if you're kind of, you know, looking for like a really kind of meticulous study of the last 5,000 years of history. And as Greg said at the beginning, it's kind of like this anthropological style. So it's like just so random. And like he tries to like not draw out like loads of theories from it. It's more just kind of like laying out like all of these sort of everyday activities of like, you know, how people have lived their lives, with the general theme being debt, I guess. But yeah, I mean, like, it's also just fun to like watch YouTube videos of David Graeber as well. Yeah. Like he's done one quite good one on The Guardian where he talks about like public and private debt. And that's like a 3-minute video. I quite enjoyed watching that. And just his like kind of quirkiness, like the way he talks is quite fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd recommend that.
His little giggle.
Yeah, for sure.
I guess I would recommend this podcast. This sort of interview that he did on Navarra Media about bullshit jobs. If you just search for Navarra Media, David Graeber, it should be the one about bullshit jobs.
Cool. Maybe we can close it out with some tunes then.
I have quite a nice quote that I captured as well.
Or maybe we can close it out with a quote.
We can do both. I just wanted to
like, some tunes.
I think it's a nice.
Yeah, no, for sure. Go for it. Yeah.
And it kind of then follows up with my recommendation of Debt. So here's the quote. In this book, I have largely avoided making concrete proposals, but let me end with one. It seems to me that we are long overdue for some kind of biblical style jubilee, one that would affect both international debt and consumer debt. It would be salutary, not just because it would relieve so much genuine human suffering, but also because it would be our way of reminding ourselves that money is not ineffable, that paying one's debts is not the essence of morality, that all things are human arrangements, and that if democracy is to mean anything, is the ability to all agree to arrange things in a different way.
So good.
And that jubilee should be like a party, like after this last few years we've had, just a massive carnival.
Yeah.
For sure. Nice. And what song do we lead into now, George?
What about Try to Be Joyful by Jeffrey Lewis?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Good idea, Greg. Try to Be Joyful by Jeffrey Lewis.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Oh, is this our last song?
One song. No, we can play a couple. But Greg, you know, thank you for listening.
We should be saying that all the time. Thanks for sticking it out with us.
But here we go. Try to Be Joyful, Jeffrey Lewis.
You can leave at 10 to 4.
to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is the Escape from Noise show. We've been talking about David Graeber. We've got special guests Greg and George from the Boys Brain Club back again for round two. And we're going to be closing things off with a song from Kitty Grant called Glad to Know You. Have a good night, folks. Greg, George, have a good night. Thanks for coming on.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Please to meet you.